Happy Sabbath to everyone. I trust that everybody had a very fine Thanksgiving. We did, and enjoyed a sumptuous meal, and nice to get together with family and friends. So we still have more turkey to eat. So my wife threatened us with turkey tomorrow, so we'll have more of that. So anyway, it was a wonderful time, and hopefully you had a wonderful time as well. For us as Americans, Thanksgiving is as I've said here, is a special time. And for many of us, it involves our getting together, as I said, with family and watching football and enjoying a sumptuous meal. And most of us finish the Thanksgiving feast full of turkey and all the trimmings. And most of us probably took a nap after all of that. We needed to take a nap because we were in a food coma. And then after the food had settled, we came back for dessert. Some were the tougher and younger ones. They went for dessert right away, which I used to do, but now I was too full to do that, so I had to wait a while. Hopefully we expressed our gratefulness to God for the bounty that He's bestowed upon us. And for most of us, we do have a bounteous meal that we can enjoy as we celebrate the Thanksgiving holiday. And it's only appropriate that we as Christians would be grateful to God for the abundance that He pours out on us. And really, the reason that we can enjoy such bounty is a blessing that goes all the way back to Abraham and his righteousness and God's promise to his descendants. Imagine, however, if we were slaves. Imagine that we were slaves. We were the ones who were going to serve the Thanksgiving meal. We were the ones that were going to pass the turkey around. We were the ones that were going to pass along all of the different food choices to the people, to the master and his family and his friends. And so the family would eat sumptuously and enjoy this wonderful meal, which we would be able to look at, but we didn't get any of it. We had certain foods that were much cheaper that we could enjoy. Maybe we enjoyed beans and cornbread or whatever it was back in the time of the Apostle Paul. Probably the meals that the people enjoyed there were not quite as sumptuous as what the master of the house would enjoy. The Apostle Paul addressed the subject of slavery in his message to Timothy. He was speaking to him about his pastoral responsibilities, and part of his responsibilities were to deal with both slaves and masters who are a part of the church. And in 1 Timothy chapter 6, he gives instruction on how slaves and masters were to interact, the proper approach that each of them was to take. In the sermon today, we're going to examine 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 1 through 11, and seek to understand what Paul taught in regards to masters and servants. So what did Paul have to say to masters and servants? So the bottom line premise that he passes along to Timothy to share with masters and servants is this. He said that both the masters and slaves should be godly and content. And hence the title of my sermon today is going to be Godliness with Contentment. So let's see what Paul had to say to those in the church that where Timothy was at. Actually, it is thought that when Paul wrote this book to Timothy, 1 Timothy chapter 6, he was in the city of Ephesus. So he's addressing the congregation in Ephesus with this letter and giving them instructions. So obviously you had masters and you had slaves in that congregation, and you had certain issues that were important for them to understand. 1 Timothy chapter 6, beginning in verse 1. It says, "Let as many bondservants as are under the yoke count their own masters worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and His doctrine may not be blasphemed." So he begins by addressing bondservants. And these bondservants were a part of the church. And it says that these bondservants were under the yoke. They weren't just servants, paid servants that served in the household. They were slaves. They were bond servants, and the fact that they were under a yoke indicates that they were in actuality slaves. And in verse 1, the Apostle Paul is not addressing masters who are in the church. He's addressing masters who were not in the church. He was addressing non-Christian masters, and even though they were, the slaves were under domination, Paul instructed them to treat their masters with all honor and respect. With all honor and respect. And why did he instruct them to do that? He said, because you bear the name Christian. You are to be the light of the world. And in your particular world, you happen to be a slave, you happen to have a master who is not in the church, and you are the one that he sees and makes a judgment about Christianity by your conduct. And so your conduct is to bring honor to Jesus Christ. And it is to bring honor to his doctrine. And, you know, we can look at this, you know, if and see that it applies to us in our context as employees. So you are an employee. You may not be under the yoke, but you work for a particular person. And how do you conduct yourself? It's something that's important to consider. So Paul here is speaking to them as slaves. And as he speaks to them, he's not qualifying his message. He says, look, you're a slave. He doesn't tell them to rebel against their masters. He doesn't tell them that slavery is wrong. That's never addressed in the New Testament. He talks about how they should conduct themselves. The bondservant was to honor his master, whether he was bad, he was good, or he was in between. It didn't matter. He was to offer honor and obedience and fidelity to that master. So in the humble and trying situation in which he was under the yoke, he was to show patience. He was to show kindness. He was to respect his master as long as the relation continued. He was to be obedient. You may think that's hard because being a slave sometimes is a very hard situation. Just as being an employer is sometimes a hard situation. And as you think about this, we talked about Joseph last week. And as you think about Joseph, don't you think this was the approach that he took in Potiphar's house? Potiphar was not a member of the church. Potiphar didn't accept the God that Joseph worshipped. But obviously, Joseph recognized certain values and approaches that as he applied those values and approaches in that household, he would be blessed. And I'm sure that Potiphar didn't always treat him well. But he endured whatever he had to endure because he was seeking to honor his master and to follow the very instructions that Paul passes along here. Christianity taught the necessity of patience and meekness and forbearance in the endurance of all wrong, whether you had to deal with private individuals, whether you were dealing with the emperor and the state, or whether you were dealing with the hardships and cruelties of slavery. Whatever condition you found yourself in, there was an approach that you were to take. And this would bring you the greatest benefit. It would bring blessings your way. Are you going to be exalted as Joseph was? Maybe not. But if you are a representative of Christ, then you have to keep that in mind as you deal with your master. Then in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 2, it says, and those who have believing masters, let them not despise them, because they are brethren, but rather serve them, because those who are benefited are believers and beloved. Teach and exhort these things. So then he moves on in the second verse to believing masters. So let's say you have a master who's in the church. How should you treat them? You notice he again doesn't say, well, because you have a believing master, your master should set you free. He doesn't say that. He was, in that particular situation, if you lived in the city of Ephesus, when you were in at home, you were a servant to the master. Both of you attended the same church service. And, you know, as you attended church service, you interacted a certain way. And that must have been a difficult situation to begin with. You're both in the faith. And as far as the faith is concerned, you're equal. But when you go back to the home, you're not equal. He's the master, you're the slave, and you have certain obligations. And hopefully your master would come to recognize he had certain obligations too. As they were both in the faith, it was they were to treat each other with outgoing concern and to have a proper approach to each other. And what usually, you know, what many times can happen is you're both in the faith. He's the master, you're the slave. He's in the faith, you're in the faith. So what happens many times is you begin to have certain expectations. Maybe that you should have favored treatment. You know, hey, we're both in the church. I need a better deal. These other guys aren't in the church, so they don't get that deal. So I should get a better deal than they have. Is that true? That would create some friction because you're going to have favoritism, and usually that doesn't go over well. So you've got to work out certain things here in order to have a peaceful household. They were to serve them because they were believers. And as Paul says, to serve them because they are in the faith, because they are beloved. And Paul tells them there should be mutual respect between bondservants and masters. Each should approach their state with outgoing concern. And probably they're going to be, as I said, some things they're going to have to learn here. Okay, what's my approach? I'm a slave. He is the master. So what should my approach be to him? Should I expect more from him? What should I expect from him? And he's the master. How should I treat this slave who is a brother or a sister in Christ? How should I treat them? They had to work some things out. But as Christ teaches us, we're to apply the principles of Christianity no matter what our circumstance is. We're to honor them, to respect them. We are to be a good servant, the best servant that we can be. Just as I said, we would be the best employee that we could be, whether the employer is in the church or not in the church. And if they are a brother in the church, then we still have the high expectation of fulfilling the principles of Christianity. So Paul lays out these standards for slaves in the church and how to deal with their masters, and lays these things out for them. And so that it seems pretty clear, but as Paul comes to the end of 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 2, he says, teach and exhort these things. So teach these things to the congregation. Teach these things to masters and servants. Teach and exhort these things. But in verse 3, it says, if anyone teaches otherwise and does not consent to wholesome words, even the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, and to the doctrine which accords with godliness. So Paul's teaching Timothy one thing to pass along to the congregation, and it appears that somebody else was teaching something that didn't fit with that. They were teaching something that they were teaching otherwise, it says. They were not consenting to wholesome words. So what Paul is seeking to do is to keep harmony in the household, for this church member to contribute to the harmony of the household. He's not trying to stir up the household. And if you look at the Roman Empire, where a vast majority of the people living in that time were actually slaves, you're going to start a slave revolt? Yeah, those Christians are advocating that the slaves rise up against us. They never did that. They never did that. But somebody was preaching against what Paul was teaching. And they were not teaching what Paul was teaching, and they did not consent to wholesome words. And wholesome words are words that produce peace. Words that produce unity. Words that create an atmosphere of harmony and unity between individuals. And these individuals weren't preaching such words. As he says, what words are we talking about here? We're talking about the words of Jesus Christ, our Lord Jesus Christ, and to the doctrine which accords with godliness. So the words that Paul was teaching and that Christ taught are the words that accord with godliness. So we see this word godliness there. And what does godliness mean? Godliness simply means the true religion. Words that accord with the true religion. The religion that was taught by Jesus Christ. the religion that brings about peace and harmony and unity among human beings. So these people were teaching otherwise, and they were creating problems in the church. So it says if a man teach otherwise, and, you know, so there were other teachers teaching something different, and we don't exactly know what they were teaching. But whatever they were teaching seems to have produced discontent and insubordination among those who were the bondservants. It was creating a stir in the congregation and in the households of these individuals. And we don't know exactly who they were. We don't know exactly what their arguments were. But their arguments might be such as this, you know, various concepts that we find in the scriptures, such as God made all people equal in his plan of salvation. Isn't that true? Also, all had been redeemed by the same blood. Isn't that true? All true Christians were fellow heirs of the kingdom. It was wrong to hold a Christian brother in bondage. All of those things, three of those at least are for sure true. The other one, I'm not sure about. But from a Christian point of view, these principles are basically undeniable. They're truths. And the false teacher's conclusion was this: slaves ought at once to assert their freedoms. They should refuse obedience to their masters. And the tendency of their teaching was, instead of removing the evil by gradual and silent influence of Christian principles, they were to rise up and throw off the shackles of bondage. You see, it's interesting that Christ never addressed political questions, nor did he address slavery. Never addressed it. He didn't say, this is wrong, overturn it. He never said that. Christ's approach is more slow and patient, giving time for the true principles to work. So if it's wrong for the master to hold the servant in bondage, you would let the principles of Christianity play out. You conduct yourself, as did Joseph in the household, and you see what works out. And it may never work out to where you're going to be given your freedom. And you know what? Yeah, the principles here are still true whether you're a master or a slave. All people are equal in regard to God's plan of salvation. That's true whether you're a master or a slave. And whether you're a master or a slave doesn't change that. Are all of the same blood? Yes, they are, regardless of whether you're a master or a slave. So you have to realize those principles are true, but you have to come to the right conclusion and don't misuse those principles, which the people that were stirring up the church here were doing. So these people did not consent to wholesome, upbuilding words, even the words of Jesus Christ. They didn't uphold those principles, but they were creating difficulties in the church. So these people were akin to being false teachers, teaching against the truth, teaching something that's opposite. And what does Paul say of them? He says that these individuals are proud, knowing nothing. They're obsessed with disputes and arguments over words, from which come envy, strife, reviling, evil suspicions, useless wranglings of men of corrupt minds and destitute of the truth, who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. From such, withdraw yourself. So these people are stirring up the congregation by what they're teaching. When you see people begin to separate into factions, and you find envy, you find strife, you find reviling, evil suspicions, you've got one group over in that corner and another group up here, you know there's something wrong. So this was something that stemmed from master and slave. It's not something doctrinal that was taking place. We've seen it, this kind of thing, unfold with doctrine, where people are stirring up the congregation. And it's very easy to stir up the congregation, sadly. But the thing is, you have to see beyond that and see the truths of God and seek to apply them. And the thing is, these people, at their base, at the most fundamental level, what was important to them? gain. Godliness, they saw godliness as a means of gain. That means that whatever they're doing, at the base of it is, they're looking at some monetary return coming their direction. That's how they saw religion. Religion was a way to make money. Is there anybody that is involved in religion in our world who sees it as a way to make money? There are quite a few people that believe that and act accordingly. And Paul says, "That's you don't understand godliness at all. You're destitute of the truth if you believe that. Godliness, the true religion, is not a means of gain." And that's what these people believed. And fundamentally what they said is, you know what? You're a slave and you have no hope of gain. How are you going to make any money? Obviously, the predicament, the situation in which you find yourself, tells you that these people aren't living up to the true religion. So they didn't understand the truth. They did not understand God's approach. And what does Paul tell Timothy? He says, from such withdraw yourself. Don't have any communion with these people. Don't in any way involve yourself with them. Get into disputes with them and all of that. There's no fruit going to be born from that. Don't get involved in that. And so after discussing the false premise that was stirring up the congregation, Paul moves on to the truth of the matter. He moves on to the fundamental point that he's trying to get across here in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 6. He says, now godliness with contentment is great gain. Not godliness is gain. But godliness with contentment is great gain. The word godliness, which we've already looked at here, and if you look at it in the Greek word is eusebia. In this verse and in several other places, the verse we looked at earlier in the passage we've been looking at, and it's in other places in the pastoral epistles. And it means the true religion, as I've said, that Christianity. And the meaning is that the real religion should be regarded as the greatest and most valuable acquisition. The true religion is the most valuable thing that you have. That is the most precious thing that you own. God has opened your mind to understand the true religion, and he says you need to place that above everything else as something that you value. The word contentment is the Greek word autarkia, and it means self-sufficiency. Now, many times we can see self-sufficiency as something negative, but in this case, it's not. It's used here in a good sense to denote a mind satisfied with its lot. It's satisfied with its lot. With contentment, this word refers to a state of mind, a calm and satisfied feeling, a freedom from murmuring and complaining. That maybe your lot isn't so good in life. But be content with it. That's where you find yourself. Be content with it. If you can improve it, fine. But you may not be able to change it. You may be stuck where you're at. You may live this fleshly life as a slave and never, ever be free. That may be the reality of the situation in which you find yourself. And we are to be content with that situation because yes, we have our physical situation, but we can see beyond that physical situation, and we can see that we have the most precious thing that a human being can have. That blessing of God opening our minds to the truth, to be able to live the truth, to be able to exercise our religion with freedom. And that's something I'm sure that if you were a slave, you would pray about, that your master would allow you to keep the faith. Your master would allow you to go to church. Hey, I'm taking Saturday off. Think how that went over. Slave, you're telling me you're taking a day off? Yeah, what do you think? I'm sure that was a very challenging moment in a slave's life. So the idea is that true religion, connected with a contented mind or a mind acquiescing in the allotment of life, is to be regarded as the real gain. So if you can have the truth and be able to live the truth and be at peace with your circumstances, then that is great gain. That is great gain. The one of the translators of the new Bible into English by the name of Tyndale, he gives substantially the same interpretation. He says, "Godliness is great riches if a man be content with that he hath." So godliness is great riches if a man be content with what that he has. In summary, if there is true religion united with its proper accompaniment, peace of mind, it is to be regarded as the true riches. The object of the apostle seems to be to rebuke those who suppose that gain, making a profit, constituted everything that was worth living for. Is that true? He tells them, therefore, that the true gain, the real riches which we ought to seek, is religion with a contented mind. Religion with a contented mind, and this approach does more to promote happiness than wealth will ever do. Now, in saying all of that, I'm not saying that if you find yourself in difficult circumstances, you don't try to do the best you can to improve your circumstance. You do the best that you can in a way that is pleasing to God, improve your situation. And God, if God is merciful and God sees your situation, and God is the one who can open the doors and give you better opportunities. Let's look at a couple of other verses that talk about contentment. Let's go to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4. And this was something that Paul had to come to grips with in his life, because his life wasn't always abounding. His life wasn't always easy. And through his experiences, he came to have the right perspective, the perspective that is what godliness with contentment is all about. Philippians chapter 4, verse 11. It says, "Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content." So he has learned, this is a great lesson, the first lesson being to be content under all circumstances. And that's something we all can learn to do. It's like I told you when we moved to Houston, I said, you know, we've adopted the idea of blooming where you're planted, which fits with that. So we're in Houston, so we're going to do the best to bloom here. So wherever you're at, you seek to make the most of it, to be content under all circumstances. Paul goes on to say here that I know how to be abased. So in my life, I've learned if I'm at the bottom and there's not much opportunity to, if I'm down at the bottom, then I just have to deal with it to the best I can. I have to be content. This is where I'm at right now. So I've learned how to be down at the bottom. And sometimes that's where we find ourselves. He says, I've I know how to abound. So if I'm on the bottom, I know how to do that. And I've learned how, if things are going well, I can deal with that too. And I can be content. And I can be godly and be abounding at the same time. He says, everywhere and in all things. So everywhere, wherever he finds himself, and in all things, I have learned both to be full and to be hungry. You know, to be full would be to abound, to be hungry would be abased. Both to abound and to suffer need, I can do all these things through Christ who strengthens me. And you look at the context of that, it's in the context of Paul learning to be content with such things as he had. And he's saying, whatever circumstance that I find myself in, I can deal with it through Christ who strengthens me. So if they're putting me in the arena in Ephesus with the wild animals, I'm going to have to face them, I can deal with it. If I'm before the Sanhedrin, or I'm before Pharaoh, before Nero, and possibly going to lose my life, I'm going to abound. I can do it. I can be a prisoner. I can be free. I can be in all circumstances. And I can do it all through Jesus Christ who strengthens me. Let's go back to Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13 and look at verse 5. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 5, it says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness." Covetousness is a sin. When we begin to covet something, we begin to want it so much that we will compromise our faith in one way, shape, or form. I want it, and I'm going to have it, so I'm going to get it. So I have to lie, I have to steal, whatever I have to do, I'm going to get it. And people crave things and want things so much that they're willing to do that. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. Count your blessings. What do I have, not what I don't have? Count what you have, not what you don't have. For he himself has said, "I will never leave you, nor forsake you." You see, Christ, who will strengthen you, is with you. "I will never leave you nor forsake you." And because Christ is with you, you can do whatever needs to be done. So we may boldly say, "The Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me?" So we see here to be content with such things as you have. Instead of thinking about what you don't have, think about, what do I have? What are my blessings? And you know, it's interesting, as you look around the world, we live in America and we have wonderful blessings. Not everybody in America does. But when you go overseas and you see some of the conditions in which people live, they're in the church and they have godliness. They have godliness. They've come to know the truth. And they've come to know to be content with such things that they have. They live in one room, the floor is dirt, the walls are cement blocks, and that's all they have. And life is an everyday struggle. But you see, they've come to have godliness with contentment. Now, again, if we were in those circumstances, we're not even slaves, but we're living in a hut, we're living with a dirt floor, we're living, eating basically the same things day in and day out. What are you going to do? Will you be content? And if you look back on your lives, many of you who are older, you went through the Depression and hard times. And how many of you knew that you were poor? Everybody else around you was poor, weren't they? They were all eating cornbread and beans. They were all living in a couple of rooms. They all took a bath on Saturday night. That's the way it was. But you know, you didn't realize how little you had until you got out into the world and our country began to prosper and you began to think, man, life was pretty tough back then. Life was pretty tough. Let's go on to 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 7. And it says in chapter 6, verse 7, "For we brought nothing into this world." So when you were born, you were a baby, what did you bring in? You had nothing. You were naked. You didn't even have clothes on your back. And he says, "It is certain we can carry nothing out." We brought nothing in. If you look at this, if somebody were to ask you, you know, ask about a person, how much did he leave behind? Every person who's in that coffin and they're going to put him in the ground, how much did he leave behind? And the answer is everything. Because if you're in the box, even if you're Tutankhamun, you're not getting much. You're not carrying, you know, maybe in there with you, but you're not enjoying it. Chapter 6, verse 8 says, "And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content." And by food and clothing, he's talking about the basics. Be content with the basics. Don't become frustrated and angry and upset because of your lack. William Barclay talks about poverty, and he's written a commentary on the New Testament. And he says, it is not that Christianity pleads for poverty. You know, Christianity doesn't say you have to be poor. You know, you go back and you look at the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were well-to-do men. They were well-to-do men, but they were well-to-do men because God blessed them. And they had, thankfully, the character to deal with the wealth. And most people don't have the character. So if you receive wealth, you want to have the character to be able to deal with it and to use it properly. So Christianity does not plead for poverty. There's no special virtue in being poor or in having a constant struggle to make ends meet. But Christianity does plead for two things. It pleads for the realization that it is never in the power of things to bring happiness. How many of you have ever, you know, you think back to Christmas and all of the sugar plums and all of the things that were bouncing around in your head. You went to bed on Christmas Eve thinking about, oh, we're going to be getting all these goodies tomorrow. I know I'm going to get a bike. I know I'm going to get this and that. And you thought about all those things and you got up in the morning and you ripped the paper up, all that stuff you got. And by afternoon, what are you doing? You're not playing with any of the toys. You're fooling around with the box. You know, your parents could have got you a box and you probably would have been as happy. It's interesting how that works. I mean, after the initial tearing open of everything, it's kind of empty. Also, Christianity pleads for concentration upon the things which are permanent. Contentment comes when we escape the servitude to things and realize that the relationship that we have with God and Jesus Christ and our fellow Christians is what is most important. Those relationships based upon God and His truth. It says in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 9, it tells us that the love of money is a root of evil. Now, money is not a root of evil. Money is just money. It's a medium of exchange. But to love it, to covet it, that is a root of much evil. And many people have gone to great extent to ensure that they have enough money. And, they've resorted to murder. They've resorted to theft. They've done all sorts of things in order to, fill their pockets with loot. But as you go back to the book of Proverbs, it tells you, yes, you can pursue that path. But it's a destructive path, which is going to, in fact, be a snare in your life. So we want to have a right perspective when it comes to wealth and all of those things. And, you know, if we happen to be a slave, we don't have much, then try to be content with it and ask for God's wisdom and help in improving our situation if that's His will for us. Let's go to 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 11. This will be the last verse we'll look at here, 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 11. So what's Paul's advice to Timothy? What's Paul's advice to Timothy? He talks about those who desire to be rich, you know, all the temptations and problems that they have. And he says to this, says in verse 10, the love of money is a root of all evil. And he talks about the problems that come with that. And then in verse 11, what does he say? But you, O man of God, flee these things. Flee that path. And he tells Timothy to flee certain other things as well. To flee it. You see that path and turn from it, flee it. Stay away from that path. And it's good advice for all of us. And instead of pursuing the path of riches and being discontented, he says, pursue righteousness. Pursue that path which keeps God's commandments. Pursue godliness, the true religion. Pursue faith, pursue love, pursue patience, pursue gentleness. Pursue all of those things because all of those things are going to bring blessings your way. And you know, I think as I look at Paul and you look at Joseph and you look at the way that they lived, they lived this. They pursued this. They pursued it whether they abounded or they were abased. It didn't matter what circumstance they were in. I'm going to live this way. And they sought to apply it day in and day out. And they prospered. Maybe not being rich And we may never be rich, but is that what it's all about anyway? We're rich in the truest sense. So, as we think about what Paul started off with, talking about masters and slaves, as we look at our lives, we can look at think of that circumstance and put ourselves there and think about what would happen. Would I be content? Would I be content with godliness if I were serving the Thanksgiving meal to a master? And I never enjoyed that Thanksgiving meal. No turkey, no dressing, no cranberries, no pecan pie, pumpkin pie, none of it. I smelled it, I looked at it, I wanted it, but I didn't get any. And when the meal is served and you're cleaning up and putting the dishes away and things, hopefully we can be content that even though we are without wealth or status, we can see a bigger picture, that godliness with contentment is great gain.